So imagine you are standing at 29,038 feet above sea level. Your lungs are just burning. The temperature is like 40 below zero, and the wind is absolutely deafening. You have just scaled Mount Everest.
Oh, wow.
Right. It is supposed to be the most triumphant moment of your entire life. But when the author Jon Krakauer actually stood on that summit, he wrote that any self-congratulation he felt was just instantly extinguished by this overwhelming sense of dread.
Really? Just dread.
Yeah, dread. Because the summit is only the halfway point. Like David Brashears, he's the first American to climb Everest twice, and he said the exact same thing. Getting to the top is actually the easy part. The descent, making it all the way back down the mountain alive, that is where it gets truly dangerous.
Yeah, that is, I mean, it's a phenomenal metaphor for something that, you do every single day, whether you realize it or not. The deep dive we are looking at today comes from an academic session by Dr. Stephen D. Mathewson, and it's titled Four Questions to Move from Exegesis to Sermon Construction.
Which sounds incredibly academic, right?
Yeah, right, totally. And before you think, well, I am not a preacher, so this doesn't apply to me at all, let's kind of reframe this, because this is really the ultimate masterclass in communication. I mean, it is entirely about that massive gap between knowing something deeply and communicating it so effectively that your audience actually cares.
Yeah, let's talk about that word for a second. Exegesis. It sounds like, I don't know, an archaic medical procedure or
Yeah, it
something.
really
But
does.
it's really just the academic term for that grueling, unglamorous work of digging into a text or a data set until you finally hit bedrock. It's the research phase.
Exactly.
It's the heavy lifting you do behind the scenes, when you're preparing for a pitch or building a presentation or just trying to explain a complex new system to your team. Doing that deep research and finding the core truth that is the Everest summit.
Right. You've spent hours or maybe weeks studying, and you finally have your aha moment. You made it to the top. But Dr. Mathewson uses this Everest analogy to warn us that communicating that truth, well, that's the descent.
That's the terrifying part.
Yeah, that is the hard part. The gap where most communication fails is right there when we try to haul our dense, heavy research down the mountain and hand it to our audience without, dropping everything off a cliff.
So, to survive that descent without losing your audience or your mind, Dr. Mathewson outlines a specific framework for us. And it begins with this fundamental realization that nobody cares about a random puzzle piece if they don't know what the picture on the box looks like.
Right. Context is everything.
Exactly. Before you share any specific detail, you have to anchor it to a larger storyline. Like he quotes the theologian N.T. Wright, who made this fascinating observation that the Old Testament is, quote, a story in search of a conclusion.
Which is just brilliant because, well, human beings are wired for narrative.
We really are.
We don't retain isolated facts very well at all, but we remember stories. And biblical theology is a masterclass in this because it's not just a collection of disconnected fables. It's this overarching meta-narrative.
Even though it's so easy to get lost in the weeds, right? The battles, the weird genealogies, the ancient politics.
Oh, totally. But Dr. Mathewson suggests you can summarize the entire grand storyline of the Bible in a single sentence. Like, if we connect this to the bigger picture, it is essentially the story of God reestablishing the gift of his presence.
Wait, hold on. I need to pause you there because, I mean, if you had asked me 10 minutes ago what the overarching theme of the Bible is, I would have confidently told you it's a story of redemption from sin, getting saved.
Right.
That is the narrative most of us absorb culturally.
And that is a very natural pushback. In fact, it's one that Dr. Mathewson actually addresses directly in the text. He absolutely validates that redemption from sin is a massive central part of the story. But he reframes it by asking this crucial follow-up question.
Okay, what's the question?
Redemption from sin, yes. But redemption to what?
Oh, wow. Okay, that shifts the whole perspective.
It changes everything, right? We aren't just rescued from a burning building to just stand on the sidewalk.
Right.
We are redeemed to life in the presence of God. Just think about how the narrative physically tracks. It starts in a garden paradise, Eden. But Eden wasn't just, a garden with nice landscaping. It was essentially the first temple, a place where the divine dwelt directly with humanity.
And then that presence is lost.
Exactly. And from there, the story moves through these temporary architectural structures, like a portable tabernacle in the desert, then a grand stone temple built by Solomon. And then Jesus arrives, and his literal title is Emmanuel, which translates to God with us.
He even describes his own body as a temple.
Yes. And finally, you get to the book of Revelation at the very end, and it doesn't end back in a garden. Mm-hmm. It ends in a finished, bustling city where God once again dwells completely with his people.
So if you are presenting an idea and you don't connect your specific ground level data to that kind of grand trajectory, your listener is just going to lose the meaning entirely.
He'll completely tune out.
But the text also includes a really fascinating warning here about forcing those connections, right? There's a term for it, typology. It's when you look at an older story and try to find patterns that anticipate a later, bigger story, like finding echoes of Jesus in the Old Testament.
Right. And when it works, it is seamless. Like David defeating Goliath is a perfect example. It's incredibly natural to look at a shepherd boy defeating a giant enemy of God and see how that anticipates Jesus, you know, the ultimate king who defeats the ultimate enemy. The text supports that easily.
But communicators run into trouble when they force it. It reminds me of like watching a Marvel movie with a hardcore fan.
Oh, yeah. I know exactly what you mean.
They pause the screen and try to convince you that a random blue coffee cup in the background is actually this brilliant Easter egg hinting at the return of a villain from a 1990s comic book. Like, guys, sometimes a coffee cup is just a coffee cup.
Exactly. We don't need to force every tiny detail to carry the weight of the entire universe.
Yeah.
That is exactly the trap Dr. Mathewson is talking about. He warns against making Jesus the true and better version of every single obscure character if it eclipses the actual intended theological message of the text you're reading.
Right, like you don't have to force him to be the true and better Abigail or something.
Precisely. Not if it totally overshadows what that specific story was meant to communicate to its original audience.
Okay, so we have our big picture. We know the narrative arc, and we know to avoid forcing weird, convoluted connections. The next massive hurdle in our descent down the mountain is the listener's mindset.
This is a huge one.
Because you are bringing this message to someone who hasn't done the 40 hours of research you just did. To bring them along, you have to anticipate their roadblocks before they even open their mouths.
And to do this, the text relies on a developmental logic from Haddon Robinson, who is a giant in the field of communication. It's this three-step progression that is so simple, it's profound. He says, you cannot apply what you don't accept, and you cannot accept what you don't understand.
Understand, accept, apply. It's like a chain reaction. If you snap one link, the whole presentation falls apart.
Completely.
So as a communicator, your first job is to look at your material and aggressively ask yourself, where's my listener going to secretly think, I don't understand this?
And the Book of Ruth is the perfect case study for this explain phase.
Oh, totally.
If you just stand up and start summarizing the plot of Ruth without giving cultural context, a modern audience is going to be utterly bewildered.
Yeah, I mean, the story starts with a man named Elimelech moving his family out of Israel to a place called Moab because of a famine.
Right, and if you don't explain that Elimelech's name literally translates to God is my king, your audience misses the bitter irony of a man whose name honors the God of Israel, abandoning the promised land to go live among Israel's historic enemies.
You also have to explain the brutal economic reality of the ancient world. Like, the text points out that being a widow is incredibly difficult today. But in an ancient patriarchal agrarian society, it was a literal death sentence.
It really was. A childless widow had no property rights and basically no social safety net.
Which is why you have to translate concepts like the kinsman redeemer for your audience, right?
Exactly. You have to explain it like an ancient legal safety net. If a family hit absolute rock bottom, a close relative of the kinsman had the legal and moral obligation to step in. They would buy back their sold land or even marry the widow to ensure the family name didn't just vanish from history.
Because if your listener doesn't understand that, the entire climax of the book makes zero sense.
None at all.
Not to mention the bizarre sandal-removing ceremony at the town gate. Like, to seal a legal deal, one guy takes off his sandal and hands it to another guy.
Yeah, it's so strange to us.
And what's amazing is that the original author of Ruth actually had to pause the story and explain this to the ancient readers because the custom was already obsolete by the time the book was published.
That's right. But the danger for us as communicators is overcorrecting. You know, you could easily spend 45 minutes giving a dissertation on Bronze Age footwear.
Which nobody wants.
Nobody. Balance is everything. You give them just enough context to cross the bridge of understanding, but not so much that they forget where they are even walking. Because once they understand it, they have to accept it.
And that is a much harder battle. This is what we call the prove it phase.
Yes.
It's figuring out where your listener is going to cross their arms, lean back, and say, yeah, I hear you, but I don't buy it. The text calls this the C.S. Lewis or the Tim Keller approach. They were brilliant at stating the audience's skepticism louder and clearer than the audience ever could themselves.
And then completely dismantling it. Let's look at the Book of Esther for this one. Imagine you're communicating the core idea of Esther, which is basically, even when you cannot see or hear God, he is still completely in control of your destiny.
Right. And a rational person living in our chaotic, messy modern world is naturally going to reject that. They're going to say, okay, prove it.
And the beauty of a great presentation is that you don't have to pull in a bunch of outside philosophical data to prove it. You just use the internal evidence of your research.
Keep it in the text.
Exactly. In Esther, the text proves its own premise by showing God overcoming impossible odds from behind the scenes. He overcomes the toxic political climate of the Persian Empire. He overcomes impossible, egomaniacal people in high places. But the most compelling proof is how the narrative handles unpredictable, seemingly random events.
Like the casting of the lots. This is so wild. The enemies of the Jewish people literally roll dice. They cast lots to pick the date they are going to execute a mass genocide.
Right.
But the random roll of the dice dictates a timeline that is nearly a year away. That completely unpredictable, chaotic event is exactly what gives the Jewish people the time they need to mobilize, prepare, and survive.
So the internal data proves the point perfectly. You've helped them understand the context, you've provided the internal proof so they accept the premise, and now you are finally nearing the bottom of the mountain. You are asking them to take this truth and actually apply it to their lives.
And this is where the descent gets lethal.
It really does.
This might be the most shocking line in the entire text for me. It's a quote from Haddon Robinson. He says, "More heresy is preached in application than it is in Bible exegesis." Let's really pause on that. More damage is done when we tell people what to do with the text than when we interpret the text itself. How is that even possible?
It happens through the psychological trap of moralizing. Human brains are just obsessed with cognitive shortcuts. Think about it. It takes massive mental energy to grapple with complex themes like divine sovereignty, systemic justice, or, you know, the depths of human depravity.
Yeah, that's heavy stuff.
It is so much easier for our brains to strip all of that away, look at a historical character, and extract a cheap little fable. We reduce profound theological narratives to David was brave, so you should be brave.
But wait, I'm going to play devil's advocate here for a second. Aren't these stories supposed to be examples? Like, doesn't the Apostle Paul literally write in 1 Corinthians that the events of the past happen as examples for us to learn from?
He absolutely does. And Dr. Mathewson is quick to validate that. We shouldn't be so terrified of moralizing that we refuse to give our listeners practical ethical applications. I mean, Jesus constantly drew ethical boundaries from historical narratives.
So where does the heresy come in then?
The heresy doesn't come from applying the text. The heresy comes from faulty readings of the text.
Mm.
It happens when we force a text to give us life advice that the original author never intended to give.
The examples the text gives of this are mind-blowing. Let's start with Gideon's fleece from Judges chapter 6.
Oh, this is a classic.
For generations, people have used this story as a step-by-step framework for how to find God's will. You know, they say, I don't know if I should take this new job, so I'm going to put a fleece out. I'm going to ask God for a hyper-specific sign.
But if you look at the actual exegesis, that application completely violates the narrative. Gideon wasn't putting the fleece out to discover God's will. God had already explicitly told him exactly what to do.
He already knew.
He knew. Gideon put the fleece out because he lacked the faith to obey. He was terrified. So, using a story about a leader's paralyzing lack of faith as your personal paradigm for corporate decision-making is a complete misreading of the data.
Okay, here's another one that feels so incredibly common. King David in 2 Samuel 11.
Yep.
Communicators constantly talk about David's horrific moral failure, and they trace it back to the fact that he stayed home from the war in the spring. They build this massive application about the dangers of idleness. Like, if you aren't busy doing the right work, the devil will find work for your idle hands.
Sounds so practical, right?
Yeah, it sounds like a great self-help seminar.
But what does the text actually say? The narrator never once condemns David for staying back at the palace. He's the king. He might have had perfectly valid strategic geopolitical reasons for remaining in the capital. Building an entire moral framework around a descriptive peripheral detail completely misses the point of the narrative.
It's like reading a biography of Steve Jobs and deciding that the secret to building a trillion-dollar company is wearing a black turtleneck every day.
That is a perfect analogy.
Yeah.
You are taking a descriptive detail and making it a prescriptive command.
And that brings us to the wildest example, Ehud, the left-handed assassin from Judges 3.
Oh, I love this one. So Ehud is a Benjamite who murders the oppressive King Eglon. And yes, communicators will actually look at this text and say, Ehud used his unique trait, his left-handedness, to serve God. You need to leverage your unique quirks to fulfill your destiny.
Which totally neuters the story. The actual narrative is an absurd, almost dark comedy about how God delivers people from hopeless situations in ways no corporate strategist would ever suggest.
Right.
I mean, Ehud is a left-handed guy from a tribe whose name literally translates to son of the right hand. He secures a private meeting by claiming he has a secret message. He assassinates the king, and then he escapes because of a massive delay. And why is there a delay? The text explicitly tells us the king's servants thought the king was just taking a really long time using the bathroom.
They were too embarrassed to go in and check on him.
They were. It's wild.
The author is highlighting the wild, uncontrollable, unpredictable nature of deliverance. Turning that into a TED Talk on leveraging your personal brand is exactly the kind of heresy of application Dr. Mathewson is warning us about.
So, okay, we've navigated the overarching story. We've anticipated our listeners' confusion and skepticism. We've avoided the trap of cheap moralizing. But if your audience walks out the door and immediately forgets what you said, you've still failed the descent.
You're still stuck on the mountain.
How do we make the message actually stick in the human brain?
Well, this is where we have to look at the fascinating cognitive mechanics of communication. We have to understand the difference between semantics and pragmatics.
Let's break those down.
Sure. Semantics is simply the literal dictionary definition of the words you use. Pragmatics is how your brain processes those words within a specific context.
The analogy Dr. Mathewson uses for this is brilliant. Imagine the phrase, "A car is coming." Semantically, that just means a four-wheeled motorized vehicle is approaching your current location. But pragmatically, human brains process context instantly. Like if your kids are playing football in the middle of the street and you yell, "A car is coming," your brain processes that as a warning. It means get out of the way or you will die.
Right. But let's change the environment. Those same kids are sitting on the front porch. They are starving, waiting impatiently for their dad to get home with the pizza they ordered an hour ago.
Oh, I see where you're going.
You look down the street and say, "A car is coming."
Yeah.
Same semantics, exact same dictionary definition.
Yeah.
But pragmatically, it is a massive encouragement. Neuroscience shows us that our brains map vocabulary against our environment and goals in a fraction of a second. As a communicator, you have to know exactly what your core idea is designed to do. Are you yelling a warning or are you announcing the pizza?
That is so good. So once you know the pragmatics of your message, you have to package it perfectly. The text points to the corporate world, specifically an old UPS slogan. "We run the tightest ship in the shipping business." 9 words. It is sticky because it is clear, concise, concrete, and creative. It plays on the double meaning of the word ship.
And, you know, the Book of Proverbs was doing this thousands of years before Madison Avenue existed. Imagine trying to communicate the value of community by saying, "One fundamental benefit of a relationship is mutual personal growth."
Yawn. That's terrible.
It is semantically accurate, but pragmatically it's a sedative. Nobody is going to remember it.
But Proverbs 27 says, "As iron sharpens iron, so one person sharpens another." It's visceral. You can literally hear the metal scraping, but there's a razor-thin line here, right? We don't want to sound like a sleazy marketing agency trying to sell life insurance.
No, and that's the boundary. Dr. Mathewson insists that clear is always better than clever. We aren't selling consumer goods. We are trying to communicate life-altering truth. If your idea is the idolatry of God's people will cause them to miss out on the presence of God, that sounds like a dry academic thesis.
It's technically true, but it feels a million miles away from everyday life.
Exactly. So you refine it. You play off the conversational phrasing found in 1 Thessalonians, and you change it to, "When we turn from God to idols, we miss out on God's presence." It's active. It's personal. It packs an emotional punch without relying on cheesy wordplay.
And to take that final step off the mountain onto flat ground, you have to make that application hyper-concrete. Vague application leads to vague living.
Always.
The text cites Matthew Kim's concept of cultural intelligence. You can't just look at an audience and say, "Apply this concept of integrity at work." That means literally nothing.
You have to know what their specific Tuesday morning looks like. You have to paint a vivid picture. Don't just say, "Be a better leader." Say, When your junior designer completely ruins the client presentation at 4 p.m. on a Friday, and the client is screaming at you, what does integrity look like in that exact second?
Right.
You have to translate the high-altitude research into the ground-level reality of their specific zip code.
You have to know what keeps them awake at night. So what does this all mean for us? It means that effective communication is a treacherous, grueling journey. Getting to the summit of your research is amazing, but it's only the halfway point. Coming down the mountain means anchoring your data in the big picture. It means anticipating the exact moment your listener will doubt you.
And it requires dodging that trap of cheap moralizing.
Exactly. And ultimately, packaging the truth so clearly and concretely that it becomes a permanent part of their mental architecture.
It takes immense empathy to communicate well. You have to stop thinking about what you want to say and start analyzing how they actually need to hear it.
Before we wrap up, I want to leave you with a final thought to chew on regarding that linguistic concept we talked about. Think about those four words. A car is coming. The fact that the exact same sentence can be a life-saving warning or a joyful encouragement based purely on context is staggering.
It really is.
It makes you wonder how much of the conflict in your life right now is just a failure of pragmatics. Like, how many tense emails from your boss or frustrating arguments with your partner are you completely misunderstanding?
Wow. Yeah.
Are we spending all our emotional energy fighting over the cold, literal semantics of the words people are using while completely missing the context of what they are actually crying out for us to hear?
That is a powerful question to carry into your next conversation.
Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Keep asking the hard questions. Keep looking for the bigger picture. And we will catch you next time.